Welcome to what in God's name?
No.
You've got a different place for us to start. Okay.
So I used to compare listening to what in God's name as eating Brussels sprouts, and you said you liked marshmallows, and I've learned that you like stale marshmallows, and I'm curious
prefer,
if you
prefer stale marshmallows. Yes.
Prefer them to fresh.
Yes, absolutely.
I think you've got some explaining to do.
You know, it's one of those things that you really can't explain. You just can't. I mean, since most people hate marshmallows to begin with or can't understand why anybody would eat them, the stale marshmallow thing just goes beyond the pale for them. So, yeah, stale marshmallows, stale peeps, little crunchy, little chewy, yummy.
Okay, you can start the show now.
Okay. And with that... Welcome to What in God's Name. He's Chris Owen.
And she is Shana Appel.
We are looking at current events through the lenses of theology, psychology, philosophy, trying to get past the binaries of politics and economics, because while those two conversations are very important, they are not the be-all and end-all. They are, in many respects, empty calories.
We are steering a course midway between, on the one hand, the programmatic secularists. A programmatic secularist is a person who says religion should be private. There is no space for any public expression of a religious perspective. To those folks, we say no. There's a great wealth and treasure of theological perspective to be added to our public conversation. It certainly needs to be added in a way that is hearable by people who don't share your faith tradition. But nevertheless, there are riches there to be shared. On the other hand, we are saying no to the quasi-theocrats. I coined that phrase. The quasi-theocrats are those in our culture who say, yay, religion in the public square. It needs to be mine.
And mine alone.
And to them we say no because, of course, we live in this. I say it's beautiful. I love the pluralism, the plurality of voices and perspectives that make up our country. There are great challenges with that. How do you find unity within this amazing plurality? So that's its own challenge. But the answer is not, yes, my religion, everybody join in.
Yeah, that singularity of focus fails to get the... I mean, the more perspectives, the bigger the view, right?
We do have a spinny wheel. It's a way to have a little fun because, in fact, we do ask of ourselves and of you some attentiveness and deep thinking. But before we do that, or as we do that, or in addition to doing that, we spin a wheel. And it's a bicycle wheel mounted on a piece of plywood. And it has a pointer, which is a sprinkler head. The pointer points at one of 16 core values and key ideas. We give it a spin at the beginning of every show, whatever it lands on. We do a brief riff on it. It helps people understand a little bit more about what we're about, what in God's name here. And it's a way for us to welcome those of you who might be picking up What in God's Name for the first time.
You know what else it does, Chris?
What else does it do, Shane?
I find it limbers up my mind. It sort of, you know, it makes my mind stay a little fluid, which is what I think we're asking our listeners to do as well, right? So just soften your focus for a little bit. Chris, my beloved dear friend and swamp Yankee par excellence has created this thing. And he's going to give it a spin. Oh, it was heading for beyond the binary, and then it popped back to me. Shana. So Chris also has a tag on the board. And generally, when the wheel lands on one of us, we disclose something about ourselves. And part of me feels like we can skip over this, Chris, because you disclosed something about me at the beginning of the show. My penchant for stale marshmallows. Let's see. Beyond that,
go
ahead.
I just think it's amazing and wonderful, and what a rich perspective it is that you bring to this show, which is your experience as a chaplain to fire departments. So I just lift that up. But of course, the arrow pointed on you, and it wasn't for me to talk about you, but I just I just think that's I just value that when you, I mean, it's a wealth of experience that you have that you draw on.
It is. And for those of our listeners who don't know, I'm a retired firefighter paramedic, entered the ministry back in late 20th century, actually. There you have it. That's me.
Last week, we asked the question, the George Floyd killing is part of what larger story? So if you didn't hear last week's show, I do invite you to go back and listen to that conversation. It, to answer that question, we turned to the language of liberation theology. This week, I want to share one of the ways that nine New Hampshire churches are trying to be part of that liberation story. In response to George Floyd's killing, nine New Hampshire churches made quilts based on George Floyd's last words. This was the brainchild of Reverend Mark Koyama in a little town here in New Hampshire. He was inspired by the AIDS quilts of the 1980s. And Anne Marie Pratt, a woman, a parishioner in Mark's church, she put George Floyd's words, his last words, into stanzas. And in the film, I just mentioned a film. I haven't told you about the film yet. I'm still telling you about the quilts. Anne Marie Pratt put these words into stanzas, and each quilt then is a stanza, a segment of George Floyd's last words. So there are nine of these quilts, and they are now on tour locally here in New Hampshire and in Vermont as well. I did mention a film. Did you hear me say something about a film, Jeanette?
I did, Chris.
So I've collaborated with a great film colleague to make a short 15-minute film about these quilts. And I'm just going to do a little plug. For our Patreon supporters here on What in God's Name, we will have an exclusive preview screening in the coming weeks of our quilt film. So if you are not a Patreon supporter yet, but have been thinking about it, now would be a good time. Support What in God's Name on Patreon so you can have access to the preview screening. So there's a quilt project in ministry, these quilts based on George Floyd's last words, and there is a little 15-minute film coming out. I wanted to share one moment of the film, Shayna, with you and see where we go with it. But I asked Anne Marie, so this was the woman who had George Floyd's words in front of her. She did this at home on a table. She had them printed out, and you know where this is going. So, and she's the one who really spent the time with these words and broke them into stanzas. And I asked her in the film, I asked her about, was there a particular word or phrase as she was working with George Floyd's last words that, I mean, they're all moving. Any in particular especially moved her. And she begins to talk about George Floyd's face, because in his last words, he talks about his, my face, my face. And as she movingly describes her her reaction to George Floyd talking about his face, she begins to break down and she, of course, apologizes, like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry I'm breaking down. I'm sorry I'm crying. And I'm on the other side of the camera, tearing up myself.
Trying to hold the camera steady.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I said, I was struggling for words. I said, no need to apologize. In fact, and I eventually got here. It didn't occur to me right away, but eventually I was able to say, thank you. I said, thank you for your courage to go to your own place of pain and vulnerability and sadness. Thank you, because that opens me up. You are able to help me get to my own sadness, grief, pain about this. And that helps me to be more human.
It's almost, so as you were telling that story, I was thinking, God is present in Anne Marie's tears, in the breaking of her heart. we become present to the breaking of God's heart. And without people who are willing to do that, without people who are willing to turn and face the pain, which is something we discussed in a previous show, we can't move forward. There is no way to heal. There is no way to build up. There is no way to change course except to go through that place of pain and suffering. And, you know, I hate to sound like a masochist, but it is what it is. That's where transformation happens.
So I was just so that's one piece of the film. That's one moment as I have that conversation with Anne Marie.
And I can't even imagine, God, that's something I'd love to talk with her about. I don't know if I'd love to talk with her about it, but what an experience. I mean, let's just stop for a moment and just what an experience that must have been. And it reminds me of the seven last words of Jesus, because that's something we preach on every Good Friday, right? And I know I've said this before, but because I'm somebody who came into Christianity from outside, from another faith tradition. So coming into Christianity, you know, I first felt like, I don't know why the hell these people have to, you know, go through this tragic story every year. It's, you know, like this, what are they, you know, gluttons for punishment? This is, you know. But then having walked through that story myself over the course of two decades, to walk through that story is to, in a community of faith, develop the muscle, the soul strength, if you will, to turn and face pain, which explains why a lot of Christians, you know, they want to do happy, clappy Palm Sunday, they want to do happy, clappy Easter, and they don't want to do anything in between. But there are many Christians who do, and I think the role of Holy Week is in the same way that a rope's course, right? You perceive danger, but you're not actually in danger. In Holy Week, we are entering into pain and suffering. We're allowing ourselves to go there in order to develop the muscle to know that we can survive, that we can turn towards pain, that our hearts may be shattered into 1,000 pieces, but it's only then that we realize it can still beat in that shape. Isn't that a miracle, you know?
In making this film, I made one mistake. Well, I'm sure I've made more than one mistake, but there was one mistake I became aware of pretty early on. We did a rough cut and showed it and got some feedback on this rough cut. And the mistake was that we began the film with expressions of people with lighter skin who fall under the social construct of whiteness. We began the film with their expressions of shock, which
centered whiteness.
It centered, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what it did. And what I learned is that to be an ally means not to center whiteness. And so we've recut the film. We went back and reworked the beginning. But it raises, so it was a mistake, and it raises questions for me. I mean, there are a lot of questions to be unpacked there in terms of what is, you know, if we're telling the story, right? We're telling the story of systemic racism, alienation, things we named last show, the larger story that George Floyd's killing is part of. What is the role of quote unquote white shock? Well, does it have a role?
I'm so glad that you bring that up, Chris, because I occur as white skinned. So I live and work among many white people and hear, you know, conversations that are, not necessarily internally monitored. Nobody's trying to put on airs. Nobody's trying to necessarily decenter whiteness or see things from a black perspective. And it is one of the first things that I heard white folks expressing you know, the white liberal folks were expressing all over the place, you know, was shock and awe that this had happened. And I was kind of shocked and awed that they were shocked and awed. I mean, last week we talked about alienation, and I guess the question is, like, how disconnected are we from one another that you are shocked by this? Because this, exactly this, has been going on for like years. And the BIPOC community has not exactly been quiet about it, okay? They have been yelling and screaming about this forever. And so, and that's painful. And so, yes, I've carried some of that pain, certainly not in the same way that communities captured therein. But I guess it's sort of like, I feel like it's hard for me to comprehend how here in the 21st century, white people could be shocked by what they saw. White people could be shocked by watching a white police officer lynch a black man.
I hear that, and I have a question. Agree or disagree? There is a role for white shock today. There is a helpful role for white shock.
Yeah, if it begins a process. I mean, if it begins a process again of turning towards the pain and doing something with it. But, you know, if it's like, oh, we're shocked, you know, we just can't believe that this is happening. And then, you know, turn away from the pain and then it'll happen again and we'll be shocked again. I mean, it's a start.
So in philosophy, we talk about necessary and sufficient, necessary but not sufficient categories of things. Might we say white shock is necessary but not sufficient?
Perfectly well stated. Necessary but not sufficient. And then I guess the question becomes, you know, because to look at the big picture of systemic racism in America and to look at the dehumanization of BIPOC bodies and Asian bodies now, that's big. And so it leaves most people feeling kind of overwhelmed. And maybe that's why, you know, the next step doesn't happen. You have to produce, you have to engage more deeply on another level. And the scary thing about doing that, and you sort of encountered it firsthand, and I'm glad you're, you know, we're going to make mistakes, right? We mean well. You know, you're putting together this film. You certainly, you know, meant well. And you started it where I think a lot of, you know, white people would have started it, because it's very dramatic. And I can, you know, I can almost visualize the opening of how powerful that be without ever stopping to think, without it never occurred to you. Because, of course, if it had occurred to you, you wouldn't have done it. So we've got to be willing to go out there and accept our own white supremacy. Because once we accept that, then, okay, if I accept that I'm white supremacist and I want to go out there and I want to dismantle white supremacy, you know, obviously I'm going to screw some things up and I'm probably going to get called on the carpet for it and I will dust myself off and I will get back in the game. That's not always easy to do. I've gotten my ass handed to me on more than one occasion. And yeah, you have to kind of rise up from that. You have to allow yourself to get turned to ash so that you can, you know, rise back up out of it. But I think, I mean, again, there is no excuse in the 21st century for white people to be in shock and awe over what happened to George Floyd. That having been said, I agree with you. If the shock begins a process far out.
We touched on this last show a little bit. Where does this story go? How does this chapter end? And I'll just revisit that for a second. Maybe we can explore it because we do have a few more minutes to explore this a little bit. I think the story, at least this chapter, ends, I say, in conversion, with conversion, rather than, this could be a little controversial, I just don't believe in progress. I think of conversion as a different thing than progress. Conversion is a radical break with the past and a new thing begins. I think of progress as incremental. And maybe both, maybe it's not an either or, maybe it's a both and here. But I think of conversion like in the sense of like a great divide between the past and what is a new and reimagined future in a way that's not unlike the difference between BC and AD.
Yeah.
But decisive.
It's like the difference between change and transformation, right? So if I take an ice cube out of the freezer, it changes and becomes water. I can put it back into the freezer and it will freeze again. That's change. But if I take a match and I strike the match, then the sulfur at the end of that match has burnt and I can't, there is no way. I mean, that it's now transformed. There's no way I can use that match again, right? Because it's been transformed. And I think of that conversion. The conversion is sort of also like breakthrough learning, like those moments of enlightenment where it's most learning happens based on what we already know. So I already know how to speak English. And if somebody wants to teach me Spanish, we're going to use my native tongue to help me learn, you know, the next language. But enlightenment isn't like that. And for anybody who's ever experienced that breakthrough moment, that aha, like, wow, oh my God, I totally, you know, that moment, the moment that you're walking across a busy street and it hits you and you stop in the middle of traffic because it is a breakthrough. It is like something that comes in from outside. And so I love the concept, especially as applied to this story. And I wonder, I want to believe that conversion has taken place. And I think I said this last week, if by nothing else, this is the first time I've ever heard police officers testify against one of their own. And in no small fashion, it has been, you know, officer after officer after officer has taken the stand and no one has agreed that what Chauvin did was remotely related to any policy that they have. So will they ever be able to get that turkey back in the box? Can they get the toothpaste back in the tube? I don't know. I guess it remains to be seen. I want to believe, Chris, that it's conversion. I really do.
In preparation for this show, I was reading a theologian named Jörg Rieger, and he made this point. And again, this is related to liberation theology. So conversion, this sense of conversion, does not lead to colorblindness. You know, we don't see race anymore. Not that. And he says also not inclusion. Like the answer is not, from a liberation theology perspective, inclusion, as though the problem is exclusion.
Right.
What he says is the problem is ongoing exploitation. And so the liberation theology response is not colorblindness and inclusion. The liberation theology response is solidarity.
Which we can't get to if we are not in touch with our own humanity.
Exactly, exactly. And that is the hope and the desire and the goal for both the quilt ministry, these quilts touring, mm-hmm. George Floyd's last words on them, and it's the goal of the quilt film. And it's actually, that's how my conversation, my little interview with Anne-Marie ended as part of the film, expressing exactly that desire for the quilts and their life in the world, because those quilts are the dying words of a man who was in agony.
Who most of us by now have watched die. Man, I mean, do a whole sermon on the second coming. You know, yep, he came. We killed him again. Well done, people. Shall we go for another round? You know, I mean, yeah. Anyway. Yeah, I hope it is conversion, Chris. I really do.
We can hope. That's God's power.
We must hope.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light. This show is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. As I said earlier in the show, join our generous donors on Patreon If you are a generous donor on Patreon, you will be invited to a preview screening of the Quilt film. You can find us on Facebook at What in Gods. You can donate through Filmmakers Collaborative, our fiscal sponsor. And there's just one more thing to add, Shayna, of course, which is you can sign up for our newsletter on our website, whatingods.com, which is spelled
W-H-A-T-I-N-G-O-D-S.
Great to be with you, Shayna.
It is always great to be with you.